What's going on, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. If you are new here, Polititeen is a podcast that hopes to spark political conversation in our youth by talking about current politics with people that are currently politically active. With that being said, thank you for tuning in to today's episode, and as always, happy listening. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. As always, I'm your host, Damien Galvin, and I'm joined by Varun.
Hey, guys. My name is Varun. I'm the co-host of the Polititeen podcast, where we strive to, you know, start political conversation amongst teens and young voters, young minds across the nation, and just bring in different issues and have discussions and conversations about them. So to begin today's podcast, I just wanted to make sure that you guys know that we have a Patreon up and running. So make sure to go on our Twitter or our website at polititeenpodcast.com and consider, you know, donating to our Patreon. As we mentioned last episode, with donating to our Patreon, you can get exclusive offers and gifts such as, you know, a sticker. We're going to have an upcoming poster to post on our Patreon, and then exclusive, I guess accessibility to our Discord server, where you can kind of ask us questions, join a Q&A with us, and just, you know, talk about politics with young minds from across the nation. So definitely consider joining our Patreon. Yeah. And as always, before we begin today's podcast, follow us on Twitter at Polititeen Show, and email us at polititeenpodcast.com or at gmail.com with any questions.
Yeah, for sure. The polititeenpodcast.com. Hopefully our domain should be coming out soon. We're working on a lot of stuff, guys. We're really excited. You know, Varun, we're working on the YouTube thing, and that's something that I think that we definitely wanted to talk about. But more importantly, you know, kind of riding on the coattail of our Patreon. You know, by becoming a Patreon subscriber, you also have the ability to ask us questions. And we have a very, important guest for our local kind of viewers to ask some questions on. Hopefully we're looking at having the superintendent of our schools coming on. So definitely remember to you know, if you want to be able to ask questions and if you want to be able to engage in that event, then definitely be sure to check us out on Patreon. But no, I mean, I'm excited about this whole YouTube thing that we got going on, Brune.
So Damien, it was completely Damien's idea, and I just kind of piggybacked on that idea. But the idea is that we're gonna have another YouTube service that is called PolitiFacts, where we have videos that basically discuss issues of importance for Americans and in an effort to educate Americans about today's social ills and socioeconomic crises. So it's going to be a very segmented approach, which is less conversation and more facts, you know, whereas, you know, on the podcast today, we're having more of perspective being thrown away. I think on our PolitiFacts segment, we're going to have episodes directed towards educating people, not about perspective, but about the objective take upon crises, and then, you know, allowing our young minds to come to their own conclusions that are not kind of sponsored or changed by what we think here on Polititeen. I'm super excited, Damien. Our next episode is going to be hopefully about mask usage and how mask culture is apparent in East Asian cultures but not in the United States. So I'm excited. How about you?
Yeah, no, I'm extremely excited to you know, offer these different kind of objective facts and do this perspective towards it. But with that being said, you know, later on in the podcast, we're going to have someone else's perspective. We're going to have Sam Park coming on and joining us, which I'm extremely excited about. He seems like an individual that's going to have just an amazing perspective and just a lot to offer us. And, you know, it's crazy that, you know, we're having all these different guests on. And I'm really excited about the whole future here and, you know, the viewers, and I hope that you guys are enjoying it. But, you know, man, there's so much stuff going on right now, and there's so much different ideas being spread around. Have you picked up on anything, you know, on social media recently that you kind of, you know, are curious about? Because I definitely have.
But before I wanted to discuss social media, I wanted to talk about what I wanted to talk about with Sam Park later today. And that was xenophobia. You know, xenophobia towards minorities such as yourself and myself, students and individuals of the minority status. I think that xenophobia is one thing, but I also wanted to discuss the kind of classification of Asian American immigrants as a model minority. You know, I want to talk to Sam about this later on as a member of the Asian American community, but the model minority myth, it really makes it hard for African Americans and other classes to succeed and come out of these bad places and gain more opportunities. Because what it does is it says that it kind of discriminates against African-Americans in and of itself and other Latinx minorities and other minorities. And why I say this is because it shows that one minority is better than the other in a certain perspective. And I think that that's not in any way true.
Yeah.
No. In my perspective, sorry, I'm going to continue a little
bit
on my point here.
Go ahead.
But the only reason why a lot of Asian Americans are in these high successful and wealthy positions is because the opportunities like the Chinese Exclusion Act have been taken away from them. And the barriers have been taken away. And once we erase these barriers for African Americans and Latinx communities, we're going to have the same amount of success, in my perspective, for these communities. So it's not necessarily a difference in how the demeanor and the attitudes of these individuals, but it's more in how we perceive these individuals. It's not about their characters, but about our characters at the end of the day.
Yeah, no, it's difficult, and it's really weird because I don't know. We spend a lot of time, you know, talking about different races, and we talk about people, I guess specifically more of color, you know, brown, black individuals. But it's weird, you know, I never really thought to myself, do you know, individuals of European descent really face kind of the whole problematic issues that we're having here in terms of, you know, their opportunities being taken away from them. So it's all different, and it's all very, very weird perspectives to really kind of gauge on. But no, I think that definitely, you know, with Asian individuals, I think that it's still difficult, and it's becoming difficult now because of the rhetoric that's being, you know, coming out of the White House with things that I find offensive to even say here on the podcast. But, you know, he's referred to it as, you know, certain countries from Asia and, you know, the Asian virus. And he's just said some really gross things and some really negative stereotypes about Asian people. And I guess it's kind of bringing back this whole, you know, xenophobia, I think, is a word that I first kind of affiliated with the Chinese Exclusion Act. But it's weird how it's kind of really coming back, and this whole idea of xenophobia is really starting to make a crawl back in today's politics.
Yeah, and you know, we talk about cancel culture. I think the president will be canceled, you know, a long while back now for the statement that he's made. And continues to make about, you know, the coronavirus as being a Chinese virus. You know, if I said that on the podcast, I would be thrown out of my leadership positions, you know, made a public example, and just I would, and rightfully so, you know, I'd be canceled by everybody. I think in that circumstance is rightfully so. But I think that Americans are some of them are canceling President Trump, but others are supporting what he's saying, which goes to show the xenophobia as well alive and you know, pervasive within our nation. To see that many people are supporting the president's rhetoric with regards to the Chinese virus and things like that, but regards to the coronavirus itself, I wanted to, you know, address some claims by our president, our sitting president Donald J. Trump, in saying that you know, people have flubbed up results and made up results about the amount of testing and the amount of cases that we had. He's even said that doctors have made cases seem more pervasive and a higher case count than they previously had. And I'm gonna look up the quote for you exactly, but I was on Political earlier today, and I see an article, and it was from a doctor. Like, there's no lie here, you know. There's no lie here. I'm doing my job as an individual, and providing a service to protect lives in America. So it goes to show that the president doesn't value the lives and the work of doctors across our nation. It's all for political gain. But I guess I want to ask you about one other thing, specifically to take your perspective on this, Damian. That's, you know, in not providing the proper amounts of PPE, personal protective equipment, 95 respirators to doctors, what does that say about how much we appreciate their service? And what is the risk of not providing them with necessary PPE? Because it's one thing for citizens to not have PPE, but it's one thing for doctors who are coming into contact with people with the coronavirus every single day to not have PPE. So what is your perspective on why this is an issue or is not an issue, and how we can move forward from this issue?
Yeah, no, well, I think that PPE, it's really interesting how in this time you can draw parallels from what's happening with coronavirus to what's happening with police brutality to the coronavirus situation in hospitals to what's happening in schools. And I think the parallel that I'm going to draw here is PPE is not only crucial for you know, hospital workers, but it's also going to become crucial for our teachers. And you have the same thing that's kind of happening, I believe, here in hospitals that you do, or even more so, you're going to have it with teachers, where they are, you know, they retire early because of the fear that they could pass away from coronavirus. They are refusing to come to work. They are making excuses. And you can kind of have this, this kind of the same situation being, you know, happening on a more drastic level because you have, you know, healthcare professionals that are refusing to show up to work because they have to wear, they have to reuse masks and they're in unsanitary conditions, almost conditions that I think would be classified as a third world country in some of these hospitals. So you have some of them. I mean, I'm sure that doctors have retired and that doctors have, you know, refused to go in and because it's not even erratic. It's just the fear that how are they gonna? They'd rather not become infected. And take up a hospital bed that someone else could use and maybe even die then go up and take someone's hospital bed not knowing if they could save their lives. So it just creates this hard situation that they're already in. I mean, it's already difficult. Let's say everyone did have PPE. It's already a very difficult situation, you know, to kind of make this moral decision about a virus that no one knows about. But, you know, with everyone having PPE, I think that it kind of makes it a little bit easier and it knows that, you know, more importantly, I think it could even resort back to a moral thing where you kind of know, hey, you know, President Trump, the communities, they have our back because they're supplying us with PPE. You know, Ford is building us PPE. Different clothing companies are building us PPE to make sure that we're safe. So I think that, you know, it kind of goes back to the military. What is it? The Military Defense Act that really forces.
Yeah, the Defense Reproduction Act.
There you go. The Defense Reproduction.
I'm going to look it up, but go ahead.
Yeah. So the concept being that, you know, you force larger companies.
Yeah.
You force these larger companies into, you know, creating the PPE and stuff that's necessary for hospitals. But something that's becoming really interesting is the fact that, you know, Keisha Lance Bottoms had to wait 8 days, I think it was, to get her test back. So we're kind of still on this waiting line. And there was a story that came out where an individual went to get a coronavirus test. You know, he went in the line, but he never actually got it because the line was too long. So he skipped the line and he got a phone call a couple of days later saying that he was positive because I guess they took his license plate and his information before he left the line.
Yeah.
So it's just it's so weird how they're just. I mean, we're still in the situation. We're in the same situation, I think, that we were back when this whole thing started. While the rest of the world, it's weird because the rest of the world's doing fine, it seems like.
It really, really does. And you talk about the Defense Production Act and how Trump has been, you know, hasn't utilized it to the degree that he should be utilizing it. And I resonate strongly with that statement because when we have doctors who, you know, Damien, I'm going to backtrack here and say that for one thing, you know, us as students and as citizens need face masks, cloth face masks to, you know, keep us safe from this virus and from the droplets and airborne particles that the kind of come into contact with people who have confirmed cases of the coronavirus. And go ahead.
No. Sorry, your audio had just cut out.
Yeah, I think I'm having a little bit of Wi-Fi issues, but I'm going to continue. Hopefully it gets better as we go. But I think that the issue here is that these doctors who are coming into contact with people with the coronavirus every single day, 30 to 40 people, don't have the amount of protections that we as Americans have. We're seeing people on the roads with N95 masks, these respirators, but doctors don't have these respirators for daily use. And they're having to reuse this equipment, even though the CDC said that it should only be used one at a time and shouldn't be reused whatsoever because it provides a risk to the doctor. And the end result, Damien, is that we're going to have a medical crisis like we have in Italy right now. I was watching a podcast, actually the Vox Explain podcast, and the NPR News podcast a couple of days ago about politics, and it told me that in Italy, they interviewed an Italy doctor, and he said he was crying, you know, every single day, because not because of the fact that people were dying specifically, but because of the fact that his coworkers, people who have put their lives on the line to support patients, have been coming into the hospital beds and taking up hospital beds. And you said that, but it's a reality in countries like Italy and soon to be in the United States. So the Defense Production Act is something that we need to utilize and Trump needs to utilize because that provides for more manufacturing. But the root cause, Damien, I believe, is a lack of American manufacturing might, because we talked about we've been talking about the fact that America is a superpower of manufacturing and can produce so many things and has such an economic capability, but really we don't, and that has been shown time and time again by this virus. It has highlighted weak points and flaws and holes in our American manufacturing system. And I'd like to draw attention to the fact that, you know, we're outsourcing so much that American manufacturing has taken a deep hit, and we can't produce as much masks, can't produce as much equipment for the virus, PPE. So we need to invest more in buying American. And I think the next president, whoever it may be, hopefully Joe Biden, should invest more in buying American.
Yeah. You know, but we're talking about doctors and doctors and scientists and such. And something interesting, I don't know if you saw this, but I think it was Senator Lindsey Graham kind of went against what Donald Trump was saying and said that Dr. Fauci was one of the smartest people that he's ever met, and that Dr. Fauci is extremely capable of, you know, being in the position that he's in. And he even said that dismissing Dr. Fauci is extremely counterproductive. So I just kind of wanted to gauge your perspective on that.
I mean, he's absolutely right. It's not productive. I looked at the same thing on Twitter a couple of days ago. He said it wasn't productive for the president to sideline Fauci, not necessarily fire him, but to sideline him in his approach towards the coronavirus, because he's one of the most respected and has been respected for decades and years as a member of the medical community. You know, you can't sideline a person who has had so much of an influence in our community in stopping viruses like the H1N1 virus, so many epidemics in the past. He has that experience. And for the president being, you know, a business mogul, not a person with any medical experience himself, saying that he doesn't know enough or is lying to the American people is counterproductive. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I'm not trying to throw any shade, but look at how his physique is. Obviously, he doesn't have any medical expertise and or even a care for
not trying
for
to throw
health.
Any shade, but he's morbidly obese. That boy thick.
Morbidly obese. And no, really. And he drinks Diet Cokes. I mean, not even Diet Coke. Cokes every single day. I think I heard he had a Coke button in the Oval Office. I don't know how true that's been. He's an old Coke button. And he presses that button whenever he wants Coke.
I need that.
I mean, I'm not taking medical advice from a person. Yeah, I'm not going to take medical advice from a person who had a Coke button. You know, and as funny as that may sound, that's a reality for us. And I'm going to take medical advice from Dr. Fauci, who definitely does not have a Coke button and has a moral forethought for the American people. Lindsey Graham, asked Damien, as we both talked about and looked at, has been counterproductive even in his own insight. You know, before Trump was elected, he was like, Trump is a bigot, a xenophobic, a racist kind of moron. And that's his words, not mine. And now he's like, specifically, he said Trump was not a xenophobic, not a bigot, going against everything that he said before. So I don't know how much we can trust Lindsey Graham, but in this circumstance, he seems to have upholded his moral right. And the reason for that, Damien, and I'm going to say this with a conviction, a strong conviction, is that Republicans are jumping the sinking ship.
Yeah.
They can't be associated with Donald Trump anymore. And I guess I wanted to gauge your perspective on why Republicans are doing so and the pervasiveness of jumping that sinking ship.
Well, you know, they're jumping the sinking ship, but they're jumping it back into cold water, if you get what I'm saying here. You know, they're jumping something that's sinking, but they're freezing in the water because they can't kind of escape the fact that that they're just, they've been wrong in the past, and they, you know, once you got on that ship, it's weird. I guess the best analogy here is before they were like, oh, the Titanic's going to sink, right? The Titanic's going to sink. It's going to sink. And then they jump on the ship and then they're like, oh, you know, it will never sink. You know, the Titanic can't sink. And then the ship starts sinking and they jump off of it. So it's like they just look wrong in every single aspect. And it's such a difficult situation for, I think, a lot of Republican senators to be in. But I don't think that it's really Republican at this point anymore. I think it's just kind of Donald Trump illican side of, you know, like this mentality that's kind of just,
I don't know what to call it, dude.
Yeah, it's just whatever Donald Trump says. And it's funny that you refer to him as a business mogul. I think that I refer to him as a failed business mogul.
He is.
I think that, you know, even calling him failed would be an understatement. I think that he's doing exactly, I think, honestly, he might be one of the most honest, you know, politicians that we've ever had. He said he was going to run this country like he's ran his businesses. And I think that he's done just that. So I have to salute them, have to take my hat off for that. He's definitely running this country like he ran all of his businesses. You know, you can go buy a Trump steak right now. I highly recommend them. But beyond that, I think that we're in an odd situation just in general with, we talk about it a lot, but it just kind of a, you know, just following Trump's rhetoric, it's a very odd situation. But I mean, it's kind of going back and writing on this whole national security thing and jumping on different things. I guess something that I wanted to go back and talk about was the whole thing that's going on with TikTok. Have you been following up with that?
A little bit. So the reason for why I followed up with it was because, you know, social media and my own friends have been talking to me about it. Personally, I deleted TikTok because it was addicting. And I think I speak for a lot of teens in saying this, that TikTok is completely addicting. And it took a lot of my time away from the podcast, being politically active and studying for my tests, education and things like that. So it was counterproductive for me. But I wanted to, before we dive into TikTok and what happened with that, I wanted to kind of just say, Damien, that right now, I just wanted to kind of show that and take a minute to discuss how unreal the situation that we're in right now feels.
Yeah.
You know, we have the coronavirus perspectives. Yeah. And we have a coronavirus, which is affecting every facet of daily life. We have just things are getting thrown at us day by day by day, and maybe a swine flu virus going on later on from pigs. And so I don't know. It almost feels like God is just coming down. I don't know. It's like Zeus is just throwing lightning bolts at us at time and time again. And it's depressing in some circumstances, but it also shows the resolve of the American people. You know, we're in a state of utter disbandment with a president who's running our country like one of his businesses, and most of which are bankrupt. And I think our country is on the verge of being bankrupt. The United States of Trump is verge of being bankrupt, one of his most failed businesses so far. But with all this happening, we've stayed optimistic. Yeah. You know, we've stayed optimistic. We've seen George Floyd die to police brutality, pass away, and you remember his name. But we've stayed resilient and committed to the advancement of the American humanity. But in that, I applaud.
Yeah.
Because I think the American people are the most resilient people in the world.
Yeah,
it stays true.
We've become, you know, we may be going on the verge of, and I think it's disappointing to see the whole coronavirus thing maybe, you know, financially bankrupting or, you know, smaller businesses and individuals. But one thing that we can say for sure, and one thing that I'm very happy about, is the fact that we have not gone morally bankrupt. And I don't think that the president has gotten us to the point where he really can do that. I think that we're learning to be resilient, and we're learning, you know, we're going to hold on for the next couple of months. And hopefully in November, we're going to see a change in political identity of the nation. I think that we're already seeing it here in July, that we're really having a change of heart in what we hold dear. And I think that this is a scary time in all respects, but I think that you know, I saw an ad and it was, you know, some of the greatest businesses have been, you know, come out of the darkest times, and I think that that's going to be true right now. I think that you know, I'm thankful, because regardless of what we say about, you know, the different rhetoric that Trump has said and stuff, it's what inspired me especially to come on and do this podcast, and the, you know, the murder of George Floyd primarily has decided, or had made me make the decision, that it was enough, and it was enough, and I needed to come out and talk. And so for that, I'm thankful. And these dark times have really inspired, I think, a lot of Americans to kind of go in and really make these decisions for themselves. But I'm kind of writing back on the whole TikTok thing. It's really weird, because now we have racism. You know, we have the whole racial issue that's going on. We have, you know, the possible swine flu. We have coronavirus going on right now. You know, we have political divide like never seen before. And then on top of that, the Chinese are taking our data, which isn't helping their case at all, by the way. We're like trying to defend them and saying that the Chinese rhetoric, you know, that he's calling them the Chinese virus is very divisive. And then, you know, the whole data snatching thing. And it's just, it makes it for such a complex situation. And I don't know if Trump has said anything about the situation at hand, but oh my God, if there's ever going to be a time where, you know, I say this sarcastically, but I'm really knocking on wood because I don't know at this point, but if there's ever going to be a time for a nuclear war with China, someone has to put duct tape around the president's mouth at this point, because if he starts talking about the whole them stealing our security and then them infecting us, and he's going to start, just going left and right and spewing, and then, you know, it's already a huge issue, but then I feel like he's just going to throw like more conspiracies onto it and say that, you know, the Chinese party was trying to, you know what, this sounds so real, that the Chinese party was trying to hack him that so that Joe Biden would win.
Well, you know, it's a scapegoat theory, Damien.
Yeah.
I think it's the same theory that, I mean, I'm not comparing Trump in any way to Hitler, but Hitler used against the Jews. He would constantly make up certain quotations and myths about the Jews to make people believe that they were just terrible people and these evil people who weren't even deserving of a human life. And he brainwashed millions of people into believing that Jews were dehuman and they weren't human. They don't deserve to live. I mean, if Hitler could do that, I mean, in 70, 80 years ago, what's to say Trump can't do that towards the Chinese community? I'm not comparing again Trump to Hitler, but Trump can definitely dehumanize our Chinese population based upon making up myths and generalizing issues to the Chinese government, to people escaping that Chinese government. You know, our immigrants in the U.S. are not part of that government. They're escaping the clutches of that Chinese government and the discrimination and the challenges they face there. So, I mean, why are we attacking our people? You know, they're not different. They're all American citizens. And I just wanted to, Let's talk about TikTok, because we talked about how unreal, surreal today's political stage truly is. And TikTok has been a source of entertainment for many teens, and most importantly for young minds, a source of political discovery, you know, because it has forced us to grow up. And why I say that is that I'm going to go off on a tangent here about TikTok, and please stop me if it gets too long. But it's forced us to grow up, because before on TikTok and social media, we would see, you know, we'd see working out videos. We'd see videos about our interests, TV shows, and things like that. And now on TikTok, before I deleted it, at least, I was seeing political things. And it forced me to realize that the issues that we're facing are more important than my interests. I stopped watching TV. I watch the news now. I stopped reading fiction. I read nonfiction now. I read newspaper articles. It has forced me to grow up in a way that nothing has forced me to grow up. For me, I'm going off on a personal note here. For me, the two things that have forced me to grow up in my life are my parents' divorce. That's forced me to grow up. And number two, George Floyd's death, right? And that's more impersonal to me, but it has influenced every facet of my life. And now with TikTok going down and many corporations banning TikTok as a national security hazard, I don't know. I mean, it goes to show that even the places where we express ourselves are being corrupted in some circumstances.
Yeah, no, just to let you guys know, when you guys choose to watch Politine, we actually steal all your data. And we sell it to the Chinese government. So you guys can't even be safe here.
Yeah, of course. No joke there. We definitely do that.
Yeah, we definitely. Full disclosure. No, but it's just, it's an odd situation. It's an odd time. And you know, there's so much stuff going on in the world, but it's good that we can come on here and have a laugh. And we hope that you guys really do enjoy this, you know, this conversation that we're having. But with that being said, we're going to cut to a quick word from our sponsors, and we're going to come back with Representative Sam Park.
Or their fellow LGBTQ brothers and sisters, right? We need to ensure that we elect leaders, right, who create space for more communities so that there is greater visibility across the board. You know, I think this is such an important conversation to have because one of the challenges I think that is causing the kind of polarization and division in our country is the fear of the diversification of the United States, right? I'm a member, I'm a part of the millennial generation, right? We are the most diverse generation in American history, the most educated, the most tolerant, and the largest currently. And that diversity is going to continue with subsequent generations, Gen Z, the Zoomers who come after me, right? By coming of age, we are going to change the face of this country, and for the better. But in light of the diversity, I think it's important for us to recognize that we have to identify and hold close those things which unite us, right? And that's the opportunity and challenge of the diversification of the United States, I feel. In that the diversity, you know, nature favors diversity, right? There's an enormous amount of benefits that come with diversity. One of them being that I think through that perspective, the common values that we share, the concerns that we share, those are able to rise to the top in which we are unified despite our differences. And that's a beautiful thing, right? I often refer to Dr. King's quote that what matters more than the color of your skin is the content of one's character. Right? I think as a millennial generation, as diverse generations of Americans come into our own, we need to recognize that. Right? We need to embrace and celebrate our diversity, yet at the same time remain connected to those pillars of foundation that make us Americans.
Yeah, I think that it sums up what we've been thinking about, we've all been facing. Diversity is something that's hard to recognize. You know, difference has been something that's hard to have been recognized by Americans, but I think it's a beautiful thing. We have to accept our differences and then, you know, like you said, embrace our differences and move forward with unity and not with a kind of highlighting those differences, because at the end of the day, we're all, you know, Americans and American citizens. Now, I guess I wanted to ask you, I was doing some research on what your policies were and your certain House bills that you introduced and supported during your tenure and your current tenure in the House of Representatives. And I've seen that a lot of your bills were bipartisan and you've worked with people from every corner of the spectrum in creating legislation. Such as House Bill 719, I believe, and other bills like that. So I guess I wanted to ask you, are there any certain experiences that you can talk about where you've been faced with somebody from a different party, the Republican Party, and had to work with them? And what have you learned from those experiences? You know, what is something that we can all kind of, I guess, learn from your experiences in accepting other political standpoints and not conforming to identity politics and political kind of seclusion in and of itself? Because I feel like outside of race, politics, political parties also divide us. And I think that me and Damien always talk about this. We always have to be Americans over Democrats, over Republicans. So what has been certain experiences that you faced in creating bipartisan policies?
So that's an excellent question. So I'll try and give as thorough an answer as possible. You know, when I was first running for office back in 2016, you know, along this theme that we're on, you know, again, my district is incredibly diverse. The biggest realization, despite the diversity that existed, was how everyone shared the same objectives, right? They all wanted safe communities. They all wanted good schools. They all wanted access to healthcare. And so for me, as representative of that diverse community, which had the same goals and concerns and objectives, I took that to the state capitol, right? Understanding that, you know, despite the fact that I might be the only gay Asian representative out of, you know, 200 plus state legislators, that I still had more in common with other legislators, even though that may not initially be perceived. And so for me, also wanting to ensure that I would help pave the way and not just break a barrier, I was very intentional with trying to find common ground with Republican colleagues, because when all is said and done, you know, I care about my home state of Georgia just as much as they do. How I demonstrated that was not just by talking about the things that we had in common, but by demonstrating that with my actions, right? By working hard, by asking tough questions during committee hearings, by coming prepared. By reaching out across the aisle, especially if there was a Republican who introduced a bill that I supported, such as HB 719, to decriminalize and modernize how HIV is treated in the state of Georgia, and to offer support, right? The reality of the political composition in Georgia is that we are Republican-led, right? It's a Republican majority in the House, the Senate, and in the governor's mansion. The only way in which I could advance any legislative initiatives that I cared about was with bipartisan support, oftentimes with a Republican getting credit for work that I may have done. But of course, I was fine with that, given that when all is said and done, it's the issue that matters. It's the people that we serve that matter. That matters more than receiving credit. So all of that to say, I think, as Democrats and Republicans, we have to understand that, one, you know, we aren't trying to destroy, you know, the country. And I think the hyper-polarization has gotten to such a degree, the hyper-partisanship, I should say, has gotten to such a degree in which Democrats think Republicans are trying to destroy the country and Republicans think Democrats are trying to destroy the country. But we need to understand that we should welcome and foster a competition of ideas, right? Finding common ground with the values that we should all be supporting, including democratic governance, effective government, liberty, equality, and justice, right? The debate should be which idea, whether it's left or right or center, can best exemplify those shared values, those shared American values that we need. And I think one of the ways in which we can overcome this age of hyper-partisanship is through the next generation, right? I say all that to say that, you know, I'll be doing everything I can to elect Democrats up and down the ticket, because I think the Republican Party today is no longer the Republican Party of conservatism or conservative principles. It's become the party of Trump has become more of an authoritarian, entity that does not at all represent American democracy and American values.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting that you bring that up, because on the previous podcast, the one that we recorded this Monday, I was talking about how I'd always considered myself centrist, and I still do consider myself centrist with old Republican values. But the issue is, and the reason that I really considered myself centrist up until, I guess, this point where I would consider myself more liberal than anything, was because the Republican Party was always, in my eyes, this party of facts and ideals, and they had conservative values, and I could relate to some of those values in certain respects. But now it's just become kind of what Trump says. How can I respond in a way that will give, you know, recognition to Trump? Because if I don't, he's gonna say that my constituents shouldn't vote for me, or he's gonna, threaten my livelihood in some way. And you know, it's difficult because obviously for Donald Trump, this politics is something that he's just gotten into. But for a lot of these people, it's not only just, you know, trying to serve their communities; it's their livelihood. It's the way that they feed their families. And it makes it in a tough situation. But I guess what I wanted to talk to you about, and something that's really happening here locally, I think, is kind of this divide in the response to coronavirus. I think that it's becoming politicized in the sense that people don't want to wear masks because that's how you show that you're a true Republican and a true conservative man, is you don't wear a mask. And it's become such a difficult stance because me and Varun, you know, we talk about it with the school system that we're in. It's difficult that we have older white men and old conservative men making these decisions that we're not going to wear masks and that not everyone's going to wear masks, when it's really our health and our education that's being affected primarily. Because if schools get canceled because of an outbreak, then again, it comes back to us and it's their decision affecting us. So what do you think is the stance to not only trying to close this gap and trying to make coronavirus less of a partisan issue, but what is the correct approach to kind of solving this whole, you know, pandemic that we're in?
Yeah, so, I think this is one of the areas in which I've been most frustrated and most concerned recently. You know, if you look at the United States handling of the coronavirus compared to nearly any other country, minus maybe Sweden, in which, the United States took a similar approach of not shutting things down, of trying to achieve some level of herd immunity, despite the fact that that could cost you know, hundreds of thousands of more lives and millions more being infected by this new disease in which we don't understand all the physiological harm that could be caused. You know, I think it's important for all of us to recognize that this is not normal, right? What we are experiencing right now is a failure in leadership to the highest degree. And quite frankly, I think the only way in which we're going to be able to get through this is to endure until we elect a new president who actually takes this virus seriously, who doesn't you know, spread lies, blatant lies, who doesn't spread misinformation about the coronavirus, which he has done for months. Because the only way in which we can get to any sense, any semblance of normalcy, and to reopen the economy and get back to normal, as we've seen in other countries, whether it's New Zealand or Vietnam, is if we have a national plan that addresses the coronavirus. And there is no national plan forthcoming. Just as we've seen over the past 4 months, there is no national plan. There's no, you know, national testing program, no national contact tracing program. And so again, it's incredibly, incredibly, you know, concerning that because of one person who thinks that if we actually take some action to address this virus, it's going to hurt his political chances, to then minimize and act as if everything is okay. Again, you know, it's incredibly concerning because it is the perfect example of putting one's political self-ambitions before the people who they are supposed to serve. Between now and November, I don't see there being any, you know, change in course. And the fact that we're seeing another rise in cases once more, without the political willingness to shut things down again, you know, unfortunately, I think, again, things may end up getting much worse than they get better. You know, I think my hope is that we don't get to a point in which, you know, that we don't reach a point in which it's impossible to return. You know, either which way, I think this pandemic is going to transform the United States. I think it's going to change a lot of the ways in which you know, the world is going to have to you know, move forward when it comes to trade, the economy, the whole nine yards. But you know, the hyper partisanship that's existed for decades, I think in conjunction with this pandemic could not have come at a worse time. Yeah. Right. In order to address a public health crisis, you need collective action, right? You need public participation, because my actions affect my neighbor's actions and their actions affect my own health. But in order to achieve that, you need trust and you need leadership to bring about the trust, especially when it comes to our diverse communities. So again, you know, the best thing I think that all of us can do right now is to wear masks, practice social distancing, do what we can to keep ourselves and our loved ones safe. And then of course to vote for leadership up and down the ticket, who will use facts and science to address this unprecedented crisis.
Yeah. And you talk about concern, and I feel a mix of concern and even fear for the future, because not having a plan on a national level scares me, and I'm sure it scares many other people. And as you talked about, you know, it couldn't have come at a worse time, our hyperpartisanship and identity politics. You know, we're having politicians across the board caring about, you know, their electoral chances instead of the American people's lives. And, you know, right now it is an issue. It's more of a moral issue than a political one. It's not about whether I'm going to win next November. It is about who am I going to protect? Because as politicians, you and others took a pledge to kind of protect the American people. And that's what we on a nationwide level should be doing. But I guess I wanted to ask you about a more specific issue related to coronavirus, and that's our education system's response. And Betsy DeVos on a nationwide level has come on to CNN, Fox News, and many other news channels, and I've watched these interviews and literally said, we have no plan. You know, we have zero plan for the future going forward. And in Forsyth County and other counties in Georgia, Georgia, especially my county, it's not been mandated for us to wear masks. And that's scary. You know, that people are being, students are being not required to wear masks, that exponentially increases the chance of them getting the virus, contracted to them through these water droplets and these airborne particles. So what do you think the stance that our schools should be taking is? Should we be mandating masks for all students, or should we be cutting back upon that in light of pre-existing conditions and uncomfortability?
So absolutely. I think, you know, masks should be mandated at both colleges and K through 12 schools, as well as our universities, our colleges and universities. Betsy DeVos aside, because I think, you know, one, just because she doesn't really have a plan to help with the situation, you know, especially when it comes to public education, it's important for us to understand that we do have more influence over our public schools, and it's not controlled necessarily by the federal government, right?
Yeah.
So as an example, myself, along with other legislators, wrote a letter to the Gwinnett Board of Education and encouraged them to delay the reopening, which they decided to do. They delayed it by about a week or two, and to mandate masks, which they also agreed to do, right? So, you know, as students, you know, write letters to your, you know, the Forsyth County Board of Education,
yeah,
out to your legislators about this issue, and urge them to take appropriate action, right? Your voice does matter. You just have to find those gatekeepers, but put public pressure on your elected officials, because when all is said and done, as voters, right, one, they serve you. Two, you have the power to hold them accountable by voting them out of office, right? You just have to ensure that you utilize the power you have to keep them accountable. All of that to say, as troubling and as concerning and fearful the current situation is, you know, I do find hope, despite, you know, the difficult situations that we're in, by looking at our past, right? Throughout our history, it's always been the youth who have led movements for change, particularly when it comes to the civil rights movement, in which John Lewis was a high school student, I think 17, 18 years old,
yeah,
when he walked on the Edmund Pettus Bridge and bled for the right to vote, right? A more recent example would be the March for Our Lives students, who are demanding reform for gun safety to protect students' lives. In the same way, I think, you know, when it comes to dealing with the coronavirus, it's going to be students having to lift up their voices, organizing and demanding change to keep our schools and others safe. The holy grail when it comes to politics, right, is the youth, right? If young people, you know, folks 18 to 30, if they voted at comparable levels as baby boomers or older voters,
right,
you would, in 2016, every single state would have turned blue except for Utah, wow, right? And of course, in Georgia, where we are seeing generational change occur, which is bringing in diversity, new thoughts, new opinions, and new leaders, you know, the opportunity we have in the midst of this challenge is ours to make the most of, mm-hmm, right? You know, holding podcasts such as this to talk about important social, political, and economic issues, you know, I hope, you know, we'll, you know, is a perfect example, I should say, of, you know, utilizing the power and the voice that you have to bring about the change that is needed.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. And you bring up using this platform, and, you know, it kind of ties into what you were saying earlier with having our, you know, reaching out to our school board and stuff. We're going to have our superintendent on the podcast very soon, hopefully. And we're going to be able to discuss these issues with him. But I guess I wanted to ask you on the front of what do you think, you know, can be the steps moving forward for younger people to be more and more politically active? And could you tie, you know, kind of how you became politically active into that?
Sure. So, you know, a few easy things I'd say would be, one, make sure you're registered to vote, which you can do online. And then two, make sure you vote and to vote in every single election, right? Because that's your power. And young folks, you know, we hold an enormous amount of power, transformative power, right? In which, you know, we're not just talking about issues or protesting in the street, though both of those things are necessary in order to control the levers of power. You know, whether it's enacting new legislation or policies or holding other elected officials accountable, again, that's power that we wield ourselves. For me personally, you know, I got started relatively late in terms of politics, right? You know, coming from an immigrant background, in which, you know, my family wasn't very political. And to a certain degree, they're still not very political.
Yeah.
You know, I entered into the political arena while I was in law school during my second year through policy, right? I had an opportunity to draft a piece of legislation that would provide skilled nursing services to medically fragile children, and then had an opportunity to go and watch the legislative process and see how the sausage gets made, so to speak. Right. That fascinated me. Because as a lawyer, as an attorney, you know, we're trained to be a zealous advocate for our client, whether that's an individual, a class of individuals, or a corporation or a business, right? As a legislator, you know, you have the ability to literally change the lives of people for the better, right? You can and make a truly, you know, impactful difference in the lives of many. You know, in the case of certain bills and legislations, millions of people. And the Affordable Care Act comes to mind, in which that provided access to healthcare for millions of Americans, right? And of course, that's an issue that I hold near and dear to my heart.
Yes.
So, you know, for me, politics wasn't something that that initially drew me, I should say. You know, it was always the policy, right? Trying to find complex solutions to challenging systemic problems that we face, right? For me, it became personal after my mother was diagnosed with terminal cancer back in 2014.
Wow.
And her battle and hardship teaching me the importance of having access to healthcare, where she was able to go to Emory Winship Cancer Institute, a world-class center, and receive life-saving treatment through Medicaid and Medicare, public health insurance programs. And so, you know, following the you know, politics that were occurring in Georgia at the time, in which Republicans blocked Medicaid expansion, leaving, you know, more than 500,000 Georgians uninsured, allowing our rural hospitals to shut down, you know, that compelled me to run for office, right? To fight so that every Georgian has access to healthcare, knowing full well that access is a matter of life or death, which is especially true in the midst of this pandemic, and where Georgia still remains structurally very vulnerable, given the lack of access that exists in rural areas, and having the third largest uninsured population in the country. But, you know, one, I would encourage folks to do the basics, right? One, you know, register to vote and to vote. But two, you know, make politics should be personal, I feel, right? Because it affects us in every way possible, right? From the air that we breathe, the water we drink, to the roads that we drive on, to the schools that we attend, to the kinds of jobs that can come into your area. Anything and everything is touched by what we do in the legislature, right? And so, you know, find that area in which you are moved, right? Find that area in which you are passionate about, and then dive deep. A good question that helped me focus, you know, my understanding of what I cared about was the question, what breaks your heart, right? What community who is having a hard time breaks your heart? Who breaks your heart, right? And for me, that was the uninsured population in the state of Georgia. Having those two things and understanding the mechanism in which you can effectuate change, as well as the personal drive and passion to bring it about, I think are two essential elements in which young folks can have a transformative impact on their communities and in their state and in this country.
Right, and first of all, from me and Damien, I'm very sorry about your situation, and for your loss completely. And it comes from an emotional spot. You know, your journey into politics. It's something that I respect a lot. You know, the reason why you jumped into politics, and I think that a lot of Americans have to come to that same realization of what do they feel passionate about, and where do they want to make change? Because I feel like politics is a very, very, very unique and pervasive way to make change waves across the state, across our nation. It is about more than running for elected office, even being politically active, because as you said, Asian American families haven't been considered as politically active for a long time. And that's that minorities haven't either. You know, Latinx communities, Black communities haven't been as politically active because, first of all, they have other issues. You know, they have more pressing issues, economic, social, financial issues, xenophobia, for one, at hand, and it kind of impedes upon their progress. But as you said, they have to consider that the change that they're making by being involved in politics is going to improve their economic status, social status. So it ties in perfectly with one another. You know, I guess I wanted to ask you, you ran for public office in a very Republican district. The House District 101 was extremely Republican. Democratic Party in your local area had no idea that it could be won over. You know, they thought it was completely unreachable. And you won it. You know, you won it, and you've been in office for 4 years. What was the most, the most influential thing that inspired your campaign and your success that you 4 years ago? Because I think it's something that me and Damien have been had in our minds for a while. You know, how did you win? Go ahead and kind of explain one of those things.
Sure. So one, I think my approach to running for office and serving as a leader definitely helped, right? I'm a public servant, right? And I am beholden and accountable to those I serve, right? Because it's the voters who ultimately gave me an opportunity to be in the legislature and to vote yes or no for various pieces of legislation, right? I think having that service-oriented mentality in which the higher you go, right, the more people you serve and the more of a servant you need to be to the people. Having that approach, I think, or that initial mindset was key to winning, right? That mindset or approach was then demonstrated by our approach to campaigning, which was knocking on as many doors as we could. And what were the interactions that were going on during those conversations? And my team and I, we knocked on thousands of doors, made thousands of phone calls. It was, you know, demonstrating that I was there to serve them, right? I would share with voters, you know, why I was running, which was, you know, primarily to expand access to healthcare. But my immediate follow-up question was, what do you care about, right? You know, Varun, to your earlier point, you know, when we're talking about politics, like I, you know, look outside your door, right? And those are the issues that you should be caring about. Politics isn't just what happens in Washington, D.C. It's what happens in your neighborhood, in your community, in the immediate vicinity around you, which you have an opportunity to impact, to influence. And so, you know, my team and I, and I think we had like a 99% chance of losing that first race, because I was challenging, you know, a very well-respected bipartisan Republican chairwoman. And folks on both sides of the aisle didn't think I had a shot to win. But, you know, focusing on voters on the ground, right, building a diverse coalition that included Black voters, Latinx voters, Asian American voters, progressive white voters, you know, I was able to essentially awaken the new American majority that existed in the district that was untapped by those direct contacts, by canvassing door to door, and essentially serving, building out a model for what Gwinnett could be and what the state of Georgia can be. Right, because there is so much untapped potential for there to be change. But I think more importantly, kind of going back to our foundational roots, you know, the right to vote has always been limited initially, despite the objective of wanting to be a democracy, right? You know, only white male landowners could vote, then white men could vote, And then the you know, suffrage was expanded to women, then to African Americans. Asian Americans, when we first got here, we did not have the right to vote because we weren't allowed to become even U.S. citizens under the Chinese Exclusion Act for anywhere between, you know, 40 to 60 years, right? And of course, we initially came over as laborers, right? And this is our history, right? That we need to understand and know in order for us to move forward. But all of that to say, as the right to vote has expanded, we need to ensure that we are continuing to expand the electorate, right? That folks who now have this right because of the sacrifices and hardships that others face to secure this right for our communities, we now need to use it, expand the electorate, and strengthen our democracy, right? Especially if our democracy, the basis of democracy, is that the people will govern themselves, right? We do not have a true democracy if only a minority governs this diverse community. And so we still have a long way to go. But in that degree, you know, we are still a part of that journey to perfect our nation. We're still on that march for justice to ensure that every American has an opportunity to participate, to use their power, and ultimately determine the direction of our country.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you. Couldn't agree with you more. And you know, Representative Sam Park, we can imagine that you're extremely busy. So first and foremost, we want to thank you for coming on the podcast today. But with that being said, you know, we want to ask you our one final question that we asked to all of our guests, and that is, if you had one quote, one saying, one message that you could leave to America's youth, what would it be?
So rise up. Rise up and use the power you have to bring about the change that we so desperately need.
Incredible. I think that, you know, it's simple, it's short, and it gets right to the point. And I think that as Americans, it's something that we all need to do. We want to thank you once again for coming on and joining us today. And with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, that wraps up our episode here at Politatine. You know, as we always say, we want to encourage you guys to go out and vote, go out and have political conversations, go out and engage with your community, and really learn and have those conversations that are crucial for us to develop as Americans, as patriots, and as citizens for our country and for the world. And, you know, Varun, any last words from you?
No, I'm just grateful to have Representative Sam Park on the podcast today. I think it was a great experience for myself and Damian, and hopefully for our guests as well, our viewers. And looking forward to seeing you on the podcast sometime soon.
Thank you for having me.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for watching today's episode of the Politatine podcast. As always, we appreciate and thank you for your support over these past couple of weeks as we've grown as a podcast and as a duo between myself and Damian. And please follow us on Twitter at Politatine Show. And always, as always, make sure to follow us on Instagram at Politatine Show and to connect with us via email at politatinepodcast@gmail.com. Make sure to check out our newly hosted website at politatinepodcast.com. And lastly, please consider becoming a sponsor, a donor for our campaign on Patreon. You can get a link to that through our website at www.politatinepodcast.com. And through becoming a sponsor, you can get some amazing exclusive perks, such as a way to contact us for questions, suggestions, becoming part of an exclusive community where you can kind of talk about your political viewpoints and ask questions of our guests as they come on. You know, live streams of us talking, and even posters, stickers to rep Politatine. So as always, have a great rest of your day, and thank you so much for your support over these past couple of weeks. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Thank you so much.